welcome to Apropos of Something. This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. As always, we are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we welcome back Deirdre Enright, Director of Investigation at the Innocence Project at the University of Virginia School of Law. Enright investigates wrongful convictions of inmates throughout Virginia. Today, we'll focus on the case of Messiah Johnson, represented by the Innocence Project, who was just pardoned yesterday. He was in prison for 20 years, serving a 132-year sentence for a robbery that credible evidence says he didn't commit. Does this case exemplify exactly what's wrong with the justice system? How common are wrongful convictions like this? We'll talk to Enright about the case and much more. And we also welcome back Emily Blout, professor in the Department of Media Studies at the University of Virginia. She studies the history and politics of media in Iran, cyber warfare, and issues relating to ideology, identity, and sovereignty. We'll discuss the recent protests in Iran, how they differ from the ones in 09, and specifically strategy the regime uses around the internet and media. Her book, Soft War, Media, Culture, and the Legitimation of Power in Iran, is due soon. It's a case study of media, politics, and ideology in the modern state. You can see all our past shows and listen to them, of course, on the station website, 947wpvc.org. Nancy, are you there?
Ellen, in the spirit of the Olympics, once again, I'm giving you a 10, if I could. That's amazing. They are incredible people in their own right, but you once again make them exactly who they're going to be, especially on the show. Amazing. I'm giving you a 10.
It's embarrassing because
I'm dismounting from my compliment like that.
It's embarrassing because without them, I'm nothing. Without you, I'm less than nothing.
I know. I realize I am, you know, putting, I don't know, 15 double D batteries into a flashlight and shining them on you. I do apologize.
Right,
but I can't help it.
You know, it's because we're really novices at this. You know, people may know that.
Ellen.
But that's the reason. So anyway,
this will be our last 5-star guest panel if I keep saying that any of this.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to say how great it is to be with you. I was away, and it was really great.
I didn't notice
to tune out for a little bit. Of the asshole country that it's becoming. I had a great time in Sedona, Arizona. I just wanted to say, just to take the view away from politics for a moment, it was amazing out there.
Yeah, what'd you see?
I saw rocks. I saw red rocks, they're called. And they have this incredible, I know this is going to sound weird, but there's this incredible feeling out there. It's an incredible kind of energy. And there are, some people say vortexes. Let's leave it at that. Energy fields.
Okay.
But a shout out to...
And how successful were you at tuning? I know you said, how did you have to work at it? Or did you realize this is easy to tune this...
No, it wasn't.
Out for a little while.
It wasn't easy. It really wasn't easy. Mm. But then after just being there for a while, it got easier. But also, I wanted to mention your city, just getting right back into the politics and nature. This week, your mayor said it's going to sue 5 fossil fuel giants over their contributions to global warming. Did you know about that?
I did not know that one. No. Thank you.
Well, no, you're welcome.
Thank you, Mayor.
So
the suit
is targeting BP, Chevron, and 3 others, and the Mayor, Bill de Blasio, announced plans to divest some $5 billion in fossil fuel investments.
That's interesting. I didn't realize those two things are connected.
Yeah.
I heard that divest. Okay, please, go on. Please.
No, that's it. And he's divesting from the city's public employee pension fund.
The pension thing, yeah. So those things are connected is what you're telling me.
Yeah, I'm telling you that.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Because of fossil fuel. Yeah.
Because the man, I know how much, I am just so, sadly, so curious how cities that are, I guess, in my view anyway, essentially blue, or states definitely that are blue, Trump, the White House, I mean, they're just coming after any blue and punishing them, whether it's with that tax, that new tax break for the rich law thing, or the offshore oil thing where, you know, he exonerated Florida from the deregulation and go ahead and look for oil near any state, you know, he's just pushing on the blue states, making them pay for not voting for him, in New York City in particular, you know, because obviously that's where he's from. And
yeah,
so that's just nice to know that there are still some laws left. I know Schneider, our, the attorney general here, is doing so much to push back, like on net. He's so busy at work, like trying to keep it together.
Yeah,
considering what Trump's doing all the time.
Well, yeah, there's much more to talk about. I know there's much more to talk about, but I just feel like I would like to get to our first guest unless you have something else you want to mention. Okay. So our first guest is Deirdre Enright. She is the director of investigation at the Innocence Project at the University of Virginia School of Law. She investigates wrongful convictions with her colleagues of inmates throughout Virginia. You may also know her from her appearances on the viral podcast Serial. Today, we're talking about a case of wrongful conviction that is in the news, the case of Messiah Johnson, convicted of robbing a beauty shop in Norfolk, Virginia in 1997. He's been in jail for 20 years. No one was injured in that incident. The governor just pardoned Johnson yesterday. His case is represented by the Innocence Project. So welcome back, Deirdre.
Well, thank you for having me. I love coming and talking to you all about our clients.
Aww, that's so great.
So it's amazing, actually, that this has been resolved right before you get here.
Yeah.
How are you feeling about, because it's been like 5 years you've been, well, how long have you been working on that case?
You're absolutely right. Well, we've probably even been working on it longer than 5 years. He's been with our clinic, which has existed for 10 years. He's been with us for quite a while. And we're still, you know, enormously grateful to Governor McAuliffe for seeing what we saw. And what he was granted was a conditional pardon. So he has an absolute pardon request pending with the governor's office, and they're still investigating that. And it's, you know, our fervent hope that they grant the absolute pardon because he's innocent. And he's with his family today. They went to visit him immediately. We're all kind of shell-shocked and excited, grateful, and we hope there's more to come for him.
So I want to delve into the case, but tell us a little bit about the project itself so we can understand what you do as a whole.
So we are part of a network of innocence projects that were started in New York by Peter Neufeld and Barry Scheck. They started the Innocence Project Network. But we decided we would be different in that we don't only work on DNA cases. In the beginning when I started this project, my thought was that there's only DNA in about 10 to 12% of all cases. And so if wrongful convictions happen at the rate that they do with DNA cases, they most certainly occur at that rate or greater in all the cases. So we take all different kinds of cases. We have lots of different kinds of cases: arson, eyewitness, police misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct, ineffective assistance of counsel cases. We do them all, and they take much, much longer than DNA cases, right? It's not just about submitting a lab sample and finding out the result. Messiah's case is a perfect example. It was eyewitnesses, and it was eyewitnesses who did not recant their identifications. So it forced us to have to find the actual perpetrator of the crime, which took some time.
What were some of those errors by the prosecution that especially his case, or in general, that you have to deal with?
Well, so in Messiah's case, and it is the cautionary tale for those of us who think that these things happen to other people and not us, whoever us is, he was literally a 21-year-old guy who left his apartment after work on a Friday night to go meet somebody for a drink. And unbeknownst to him, one of the victims of the armed robbery in a beauty salon that had happened 2 weeks before was doing what eyewitnesses do all the time when the crimes go unsolved. They are perpetually looking for the perpetrator, right? Wherever they are looking to see if the person who did this to them is there. And this man was in a car. He was a passenger in a car and saw Messiah from, I think, 60 to 70 feet. walking into a club with a very bad lighting situation, saw his eyeglasses and just decided that that was the perpetrator. And then the police misconduct then occurred, because they then went and took Messiah out, handcuffed him, sat him on a curb, drove the victims together, two of them, by him, and then said, "Is that him?" So that's called a show up, and that's a big no-no. And that began the whole trail of one thing leading to another. But literally, he was going out for a drink with a friend and just has never come home since then.
What happened with the defense in that case?
So he first had a court-appointed lawyer who did the preliminary hearing in his case, where that was his first chance to look the victim identifiers in the face. Their stories were way out of line, way out of whack, and they didn't get the hearing transcribed. So he was never able to use those mistakes. He got rid of that lawyer. His family hired a lawyer who, the first trial ended in a mistrial because of the fact that the police, the eyewitnesses, admitted that there were photographs they had seen and identified someone else, and that had not been turned over to the defense. They ordered a mistrial, had another trial, and that time the same thing happened, but the judge did not order a mistrial. So,
and as I recall from one of the articles that I read about this case, there was even misleading information the jury was given before they deliberated about parole. Is that right?
Right.
The parole
had
something to do with even worse for him, right?
There was a lot of the jurors who are, some of whom have talked to us since then, that there had just been a decision about whether or not you could talk about parole and whether you were parole eligible. And of course, even though jurors are told that they shouldn't consider that, everyone talks about that, right? And there was a double problem in this case, because the jury wasn't clear on, there were two robbers and they weren't clear which robber the Commonwealth was saying he was, because it was only him at the defense table. There wasn't a second person at his trial. And so in the end, they found him guilty of all the charges of both robbers, hence the 132-year sentence. And that was largely because they didn't know what they were being asked to decide, and no one was instructing them.
And someone came forward to confess. Is that true?
So the amazing thing about this, and this doesn't, I hate to insinuate that I'm in any way ungrateful for what happened yesterday, but what really the case is that this should have never happened to begin with. Because at the time that this was all going on, there was a couple of people robbing places using the MO that was used in this case, right? Wearing the same kind of clothes, disguises, saying the same kind of things to the people in the shops. It was all in the Ghent neighborhood in Norfolk, Virginia. And it was in the newspaper that they were looking for a certain person for this crime, for this specific crime. And he ended up being arrested 2 days after Messiah. So they just peeled this one crime off and left it in Messiah's lap instead of, connecting the dots and realizing that this person did all of them. And literally, I went with a student on a Saturday afternoon to the prison where he is, and walked in, we didn't have much time with him, and just said, we think that you might be. And he immediately said, "Oh, yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. The beauty salon. Yeah, that was me."
Oh, gosh.
So it was all solvable in real time.
My God. I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's just, Messiah, I think, has the best take on this. And Mr. Humphreys, who admitted to this, said he thinks it's amazing that they didn't realize, because he said, I had a crack problem. I was poor. I had nothing. I had no job. I was addicted. And he said Messiah had a job. Messiah looked put together. Messiah had an alibi. Messiah had a family. Like, he had jewelry. And he said they just thought we were all, it's all just black people. It was just black. We were just the same thing. Mm-hmm. And he said it was the actual perpetrator who said, if you paid any attention, you would have known.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's obviously incompetence, but what is it that is causing such issues, and is there any repercussions to that? Obviously, it seems not.
So, one of my terror in this work is that we now know about all these mistakes, right? We know about tunnel vision. We know about eyewitnesses. We know that we lead witnesses to say things. We know we pressure them, but we haven't done anything to correct all these things. Mm. And so the lawyer in this case got paid a certain amount. And I think what he was calculating was that he would do one trial. And then there was a second trial, and there was, you know, no, he didn't have very much money. He wasn't an investigator. And we need to change that. People need to get paid. So our Innocence Project spends a lot of time doing things that should have been done back in the day, right? And reading the newspaper that was available at the time doesn't seem like a hard sell for a trial attorney, right? Mm-hmm. So when you read these cases, what you realize really is that people don't invest in their cases and in their clients, and they're not paid to do that either.
That is so depressing. I never, you know, I hear you. I know that. I'm sorry. That is just so depressing to think that is in your view sometimes why a judge, like I know that a state judge, I believe it was a state judge, someone heard this, your case when you brought it back, you know, trying to get this overturned, this ruling, and the state judge didn't feel like it was his. He could put the guy behind bars, but he didn't feel it was his job to overturn it or to really let, you know, your evidence have its merit and push it up to the federal court. Is that the same motivation, like to puff up their record? Is that what that comes down to?
So this is an issue for us, is the fact that back in the day, it was all fine to prosecute Messiah and say everything you want to say, police and prosecutors in court. And now you hear nothing from them, right? And so we had some hope that we would go back in front of the judge where the mistake occurred, and that he would want to fix this, and that he would be invested in fixing this, and that maybe he would even think that he was had. He was a new judge back when this happened, and that maybe he would think that it was his, that it, he would take pride in fixing this mistake. But he said for procedural reasons, he didn't believe that the case was properly before him. We disagree. We've appealed. We're not done. But there certainly isn't any, you would think that a prosecutor who took their job seriously and heard that they might have been involved in a wrongful conviction, advertently or inadvertently, that you would think, oh my God, I need to fix that. I don't see that. I don't see people coming forward in any regular capacity to own their work.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're going to go to a break. We've been speaking with Deirdre Enright, and we'll continue speaking with her. She's the director of investigation at the Innocence Project at the UVA School of Law. And we're going to talk with Emily Blout a little bit later. Stay tuned to Apropos of Something on 94.7. Welcome back to Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday from 10 to 11. I'm Ellen Daniels. I'm talking with my host, co-host Nancy Lawrence, and our special guest, Deirdre Enright, director of the investigation at the Innocence Project. So, Deirdre, we were talking a little bit. I wanted to bring up something that you had mentioned. So, you're working with more than just this case, obviously. I don't know how many. How many are you working with?
So it varies, but we have things filed in probably 6 or 7 cases now, maybe more. We have pardon requests, and we have litigation in courts. So there's various things. We have our clinic, which is 12 students, and then we have a volunteer clinic, which is probably 50 students. So lots of cases.
So in those cases, you mentioned that sometimes people come forward. What happens? What's been happening with those cases, and what's interesting about that to you?
So there's a number of cases that are in our clinic right now where the actual perpetrator has confessed to the crime, Messiah's case being one of them. But there's also a case, Gary Bush, where we have a writ of actual innocence filed, where a man literally walked into the police station one day and said, I can't live with myself any longer. I want to admit to these bank robberies. They challenged him. They thought he was crazy. They said it couldn't be possible. They didn't realize at that point that somebody else was actually locked up for those crimes. And eventually he said, if you don't arrest me for this, I'm going to go commit one in the same way so that you have to. Mm. So he was arrested. He's now been convicted of that crime. He's serving his time. He's apologized profusely. He had no idea that anybody had ever been locked up for these crimes. And the other man has been released. But we don't know yet whether the attorney general will oppose that motion, right? So it's a case where you just think there's another man convicted. He's already, the Commonwealth has charged him and convicted him. And that should be a real simple case. And I hope it will be one.
Right.
So there's him. Then there's Messiah. We have another client, Rojay Fentress, who he just happened to meet a guy in prison 20 years after he was locked up at the age of 16. And the guy heard about what he was accused of and said, holy, you know what? That's my crime. I did that. And he filed an affidavit. He gave him an affidavit. He explained the circumstances. And the federal judge, without a hearing, said, that kind of thing happens all the time. People get together in prison and they admit to other people's crimes. That's what happens. Now, that's absurd. Mm-hmm. And without a hearing, to have a federal judge decide what goes on in a prison is almost laughable. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have the only honorable person in the room being the perpetrator. Right.
Yeah.
Like, it's absurd.
Yeah. It is absurd.
Who's in favor of the rule of law?
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, and the other thing just to point out
is, and
it's
not funny. And I apologize. It's really sad.
No, I mean, it's appalling. And if you dwelled on it, you would become as insane as me. I want to point something out. People love to say, and someone will say it right soon, that the system has worked. Messiah Johnson got his conditional pardon. That, too, is absurd, right? He's spent 20 years, more than 20 years in prison. And also, we're not part of the system. Innocence projects are self-created, self-funded, we're not part of the system. We are what comes up and sort of cleans up after the system, right? Yeah. We're not paid by the state. And we have a backlog of 800 cases, and that's Virginia. That's just Virginia. So we should be very, very concerned about the fact that we have a system that makes these mistakes and has no skin in fixing it.
Was it always this way in your career?
Well, so for a really long time, what I did was work on post-conviction death penalty cases. And that's, you know, a very different animal and a very different process. At least there's guaranteed processes for people on death row. But I worked on way too many cases where the death row inmate turned out to be innocent.
Mm.
Like that shouldn't be anybody's experience.
Are there other innocence projects around the country?
So they're everywhere now.
Okay.
Most are with law schools. Some are independent, but now they're also global. Now we routinely get on our listserv notifications of innocence projects in other countries. So it's not just our own problem, but it's all the same issues that are everywhere, like the eyewitness, the police misconduct, the prosecutorial. And, you know, part of that is because we don't have any, there's no ramifications for for the misconduct.
Right.
People do not
right.
get in trouble for this.
Right. Yeah. I was wondering, actually, before I get too far away from Messiah Johnson, who got to tell him about the conditional? I get a conditional pardon. And is he, well, first of all, who got to tell him that? And what was that like for whomever got to tell him?
So I got to tell him. sadly, my partner, Jennifer Givens, was sick yesterday. And so we got her on the phone and we both, you know, got to tell him the sort of the legal ramifications. Yeah. He was delighted, right? He was floating.
Yeah.
The real emotional gut check was hooking him up to talk to his family. Mm-hmm. And there was a whole lot of crying going on there. And I couldn't take it, so I went and sat at my desk and put my head in my hands. Because I'm an emotional cripple.
No, that's fantastic.
You chose the best line of work, dear.
I know.
Yeah.
My poor children.
Oh. When does he leave prison? Is he out? And what's the deal with this conditional part in terms of his life for now?
So he has to go to a reentry program. How's that? Because he's been in so long, he has to go somewhere to be trained how to leave. So he has, and that would be a 5-month program. If we can get his absolute pardon granted in the meantime, he could leave as soon as the absolute pardon was granted. So that would be ideal.
And is
then,
he able to? Okay,
oh,
sorry.
No, go ahead. No, no, no. You.
I was just wondering, is he able to live at home with this pardon as it stands, or no?
Yeah, he will be under like supervisory conditions, like anybody who's released on, you know, with conditions. And I don't know what those are yet. We did not see what he had to sign off on. We're hoping he needs medical attention. He has horrible spine problems that have not been dealt with. So I suspect he's going to need surgery, and I'm hoping he'll come to Charlottesville and get to UVA for medical attention. And he's an incredibly articulate person, and I would love to see him speak.
Yeah.
And he's an activist, so he will speak.
Will he come here?
Oh, he will come here.
Great.
That's a great question, Ellen. Yeah. That would be excellent.
Yeah. He's obviously far more interesting than me.
No.
Yes.
I'm sure.
And he'd be the first to tell you that.
Go sit at your desk. No, that is not what we meant at all. That's not it. Why is Virginia, Deirdre, is in your view, is Virginia any more? Let me say it the other way. Is it harder to get a conviction overturned in Virginia versus other states, or is this the way it is across the country?
So I guess I have two ways to answer that. I think Virginia has a lot more. We certainly have harsher procedural rules than most states. And we have our unforgiving 21-day rule that you cannot, you know, put in evidence of your innocence discovered after 21 days after you're convicted. Now, there's ways around that, and obviously we do that. But we have very, very harsh procedural rules, and we pay lawyers very little to defend the indigent. That said, everybody on my listserv thinks that where they are is the worst place ever. So, I know what we do here, and I know how hard it is here. I know Messiah might have gotten relief earlier in another place.
Mm. So what other cases? Oh, I'm sorry, Nancy, do you want to piggyback on that?
I was curious, this whole writ of actual innocence with DNA, sorry, versus without DNA, is the difference, it's hard enough, it seems like, with DNA. How much more difficult is it for these other kinds of cases?
Much more difficult to file a writ of actual innocence based on non-biological evidence. Although what you should have to do is present enough evidence that a reasonable juror would not convict somebody. We have found that what you really essentially have to do is solve the crime, right? That in order to prove that your client is innocent, and that's a burden that nobody has to meet at trial for sure.
I wanted to ask you, Deirdre, what other cases stand out to you that you've been involved with that were wrongful convictions that you've turned around?
Oh, I mean, I have to say, this is my answer always is, you know, having done worked on Serial, our reaction to Serial was that it was fascinating that the entire country was fascinated by Serial, because every one of our cases is just like that. Mm. It's fascinating. And every one of our cases is obsessing. And every case, every person is amazing, right? Like, we rarely have clients that we don't adore, and that, for all their, you know, good and bad and frailties, and but they're fascinating if you dig in, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what's the problem with these trials, is if you go sit at a trial for an average criminal case, there's nothing fascinating going on. Most of the time, the jurors will tell you they didn't really understand half of the evidence or the experts, or, you know, and they went off and made their own decisions about things that weren't at issue. And, you know, we have to find a way to tell these stories in the complicated, textured world we live in. Mm-hmm. And that's not what happens in court.
And other people, as I'm talking to you, I'm thinking, what can we do as lay people who aren't lawyers or students of law to help?
So people ask us this after when we do, you know, fundraisers and things like that. And I'm always struck by how many people offer to help. And our biggest thing is, we've expanded quite a bit since we started the project. We've got a second project. We've now got two directors. We've got but we cannot supervise. Like, all these people that want to help, we would love them to help. So, but we can't supervise them. So we're trying to raise money now to have two more fellows so that we could have double the cases, so that we could maybe even have a volunteer group from the community. Mm-hmm. So I would love the physical help that people are always offering, but I can't manage it. So I keep telling people, donate to our clinic. Like, we have a second clinic that we run out of our own funds, and that would be enormous if we could have two fellows and double the load and double the volunteers.
And I'm sure we can find that. People can find that on the UVA School of Law website.
Yep. Every donation is worth a lot to us.
And while you're at it, donate to the station so we can keep talking about these issues. 947WPVC.org. We never do fund drives. I just did one right there. So
that was so well done, too.
Thanks, guys. Well, thank you so much for being here, Deirdre.
Yes,
and
Deirdre,
please come back again.
Yeah.
We love talking with you.
Well, you guys know that I'll come and talk your ears off.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That's what we love to do.
Good.
Nancy, do you have a news of note?
Ellen, I do have a news of note. It's about our administration, if you can believe it. Actually, it's about our Dotard, I believe, is the current vernacular. Very stable genius. Anyway, which is specifically about that term in a way. The veteran nuclear launch officers sent a letter to Congress during the week to rein in Trump's ability to launch the nuclear first strike. It's that no individual, especially Donald Trump, should hold the absolute power to destroy nations, was the top of the letter. And 17 former nuclear launch officers issued a grave warning regarding Trump's unfettered access to nuclear weapons, declaring that the current U.S. nuclear launch process poses a clear and present danger to the country and the world, and that no one, not the Secretary of Defense, not the Attorney General, not Congress, no one can stop that order, and there are no reliable safeguards in place to contain that power. It is unprecedented to see so many former nuclear launch officers speaking on the record, speaking out, rather, against the sitting commander-in-chief. It's not something they do something so political. But they, you know, he doesn't have the stability, about what I was saying earlier, stability, the competence, the temperament. Trump has shown that he possesses none of that.
Wow.
Astounding that they went on record. Anyway, what do you got?
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. Fire and Fury, there's another book that's called the same thing as Fire and Fury that we know, with Trump ranting on the cover. But there's this military history book that's been getting really good. It's become a bestseller, basically, or top 10, because it has the same name. That was a roundabout way of saying there's another book. But also, I really wanted to bring attention to the whole Oprah thing, the speech that she did.
Uh-huh.
Dahlia Lithwick, she is a Charlottesville person who moved away just recently, but used to be on this network or this program before. And she writes these great pieces for Slate and summed it up by just saying that we're really misperceiving that whole speech. A lot of people thought, okay, she should run for president, which would be much better than what we have now, agreed. But that she said she heard... what she heard was Winfrey urging invisible people to speak up, become engaged, transform policy, and find their own power. It was a speech about moving from passivity and acceptance to furious, mobilized participation, and a call for allies in that fight.
That's what I
thought was so astute of her to point that out.
Yeah, it was. On the one hand, it wasn't surprising, but yet when I was watching it, I wasn't thinking that, but it just, like, we just don't learn our lessons, you know? I mean, the minute someone of note says something profound, you should run, we will totally vote for you.
Right. Well, like, we are a bit desperate now. I don't blame us.
Yeah. Yeah, true.
Okay.
I know. We would drink sand.
We would. So I'm ready to talk with Emily. How about you?
Totally.
Okay. Emily Blaut is here. We welcome her back. She's a professor in the Department of Media Studies at UVA, where she teaches and studies the history and politics of media in Iran, cyber warfare, and issues relating to ideology, identity, and sovereignty in hypermedia space. Blaut has 8 years of experience working on foreign policy and national security issues in D.C., advising and serving as a spokesperson for a senior member of Congress, and working on Turkey and Syria issues at the Pentagon. In a brief moment, we're going to talk with her about the recent protests in Iran, the differences between these protests and the one in 09, and how they are, how the differences in the regime's cyber warfare strategy are occurring. Blatt has written the book, or will be releasing the book soon, called Soft War, Media Culture, and the Legitimation of Power in Iran. It's a case study of media politics and ideology in the modern state. Welcome back to the program, Emily.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yes. So this was a rare rash of protests, I guess, that broke out December 28th in Iran. 21 deaths, at least when I last looked, and 450 arrests against what I think was against the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khomeini. Well, how does this differ from the last period, which was the 09 Green Movement, where there were millions of people protesting?
Well, thanks. That's a good kind of summary. Two confirmed dead in prison, and then 21 people dead during the protests themselves. The protests took place in over 80 cities across the country. And there are now, according to Human Rights Watch and other sources, around 3,700 people imprisoned. Wow. Relating to these protests. So they are largely subsided, but they did go on for quite some time. It are about 13, 14 days, so 2 weeks. And they were quite extraordinary for a number of reasons. But primarily, I think, to Iran watchers and to the West, the thing that was the most extraordinary or, unique was the overwhelming impassioned displays of anti-government sentiment and also a secular sentiment that we had not seen before. Some of the protests, the chants that were being proliferated across the country and many times, and it didn't seem like as if they were actually coordinated, were with regard to we want a Iranian republic, we not an Islamic republic. We down with the clerics and such. So that was extraordinary and interesting. Just to get back to your question, though, about what is different now between now and 2009.
I may stop you just to get to a heartbreak so we can come back and we'll pick up with that, because I know it's probably going to be a really great answer and I want to have time for it. So we're going to go to this heartbreak, unfortunately or fortunately for our sponsors. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. Took a short break. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I interrupted Emily as she was about to answer a question. We're talking with Emily Blaut, professor in the Department of Media Studies. We're talking about the recent protests in Iran and the differences between the ones that happened in 09 and the ones just this December.
Thanks. Just to follow up. So you asked what the differences were. And are. And, I say this to my students. I teach a class at UVA called Media and Power in Modern Iran. And we go through different points in Iranian history in which the dominant paradigm, the system of media, was threatened. So you see this being threatened. The system of media control was threatened with the advent of satellite TV, for example. Then you see it threatened by the internet. So these are different iterations. And one of the things that my students ask me when we get to this conversation is, why didn't, in the 2009 protests, why didn't the Iranian regime just turn it off? Turn off the internet and turn off the prominent means by which the demonstrators were organizing and advancing their discourse of dissent. Why didn't the regime at this point in 2009 turn off the internet? And it's a great question, and it's something that we reflect on in the class. And the finding here, and what I'd say to them, and I say in my book is, because of the quite advanced understanding of the Iranian government of the problems inherent in censorship or overt censorship. So instead of turning off the internet, which there you can argue that there's technical difficulties of that, but it, certainly the capability was there in 2009. The Iranian regime elected to throttle and slow down the internet. So this is something that we media scholars call third generation controls. So it is an advanced method of doing what dictatorships have done in time immemorial, which is censorship and repression and the violation of speech and expression. And so doing that in 2009, the calculation was, look, if we turn off the internet, it's going to look really bad. it doesn't present a good face to the international community, and it will be incredibly disruptive to our own economy, which is certainly true in 2009. What has changed now? You know, we saw on December 30th that there was a marked downturn in international internet traffic in Iran, between Iran and the international community. You could call that very much a shutdown of the international network and connectivity. And, you know, that was substantial for people like me who was watching this, because this suggests that option, again, is on the table, and it was taken advantage of this time around. So the Iranian government this time did elect to shut down the internet. Again, this is an oversimplification, but the idea is that the Iranian government has been able to, with far better acumen and better acumen, shut down or to limit the information that is transmitted between Iran and the international community. That's the difference, I think, among other things.
And what about these protests now, the ones going on, or sort, you know, recently anyway? One of the things I noticed was that there was no leader. It seemed like people were just going on the street. There wasn't someone, a spokesperson or an organization. Did that affect, in your mind, did that affect how far they got? Or, yeah, did that affect how much of an impact this protest made?
Certainly. That's a great observation, Nancy. This was very much a leaderless movement. And it was, in some ways, unplanned. It was certainly sparked by some factional infighting. This began in the province in the city of Mashhad, which is the stronghold of Rouhani, the president Rouhani's major opponent, Raisi, and his ilk. And it began, you know, as a way to criticize the president and his policies and his economic policies and shortcomings, but quickly blossomed into something much more, much greater, and certainly sincere expressions of rage and discontent with the economic policies, the political policies, and the quality of life of many people, especially in the provinces. And I think that's another thing, actually, is that this is... The previous movement was something that began in the interior and in urban centers and escalated out to the peripheries, to the rural areas. And this was the opposite. It began in rural areas and among the poor and working class, as opposed to among the urban middle class.
Do you think it's, even though it maybe has sputtered out by now and it involved less people, that it's a deeper or, you know, indicate something more, a deeper discontent with the ruler?
Certainly. I would just clarify that it hasn't so much sputtered out as been quelled and quenched effectively by the Iranian government. Mm-hmm. You know, masses of people have been imprisoned. One of my sources says that, you know, school children, high school kids have been, she saw high school kids rounded up and taken away in vans. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly a degree of repression and violence employed by the state to quench these protests. They didn't naturally dry up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good point. And how do you see, I mean, are you following, you probably are, what our regime is doing, and how is that effective or fanning the flames?
Well, what a gift what a gift that President Trump offered to the Supreme Leader and the conservative and hardline members of the regime, and even President Rouhani. What a gift it is when you provide an apt and, you know, vuncular enemy to concentrate everyone's attention on. Mm-hmm. It's a great way to say, look what America is doing. I told you all that, you know, forever that America was out to get Iran, and it was had no intention of abiding by this nuclear deal. So, you know, this kind of messaging, I think, certainly fans the flames and doesn't do anything to help the situation
right.
within Iran or in the diplomatic sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, given that it is him and them, do you think the U.S. should get involved at all in what's going on over there? Given that it's going to be Trump and his White House?
I just don't even see how America is relevant in many ways. I think we did that intentionally and unintentionally, and our continued and increasing isolation on the diplomatic theater in the U.S. and in the world. It really suggests that we really have few levers right now to affect something in Iran or anywhere.
Mm-hmm. How so? You know, I was thinking, what's to stop them from just turning it off? Like, they were afraid it didn't look good. Why do they even care about that? Because they wield so much power within their own country. I guess you could address that one.
Great. Well, thanks for coming back to that. So this is the thing that is most fascinating for me and most troubling for human rights observers and for free speech observers and the international community. Iran has gotten pretty far in constructing and implementing a national internet project, so a domestic internet. And so the main difference between 2009 and today is that there is now the scaffolding and the infrastructure to cut Iran off from the international community, from the global internet, and still have a functioning economy, information economy. So this is one of the most advanced technologically savvy communities in the world, you know, the highest amount of mobile cell phones, internet connections. There's vast, movement in the right direction on terms of connectivity and internet speed. And yet there's also a growing ability to control and censor the net.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the government could ever be vulnerable to protests? Were you anticipating anything when these first broke out?
Well, I think this is, I think this certainly will have some kind of impact on the popular psyche. I don't understand. I can't see a situation in which this would not. The proliferation of images of violence and dissent and just an anger and dislocation that really occurred over 5 days at least before that they really clamped down on media will do something to the regime's legitimacy long term. From what I know, you know, about the sources of legitimacy in Iran, we know much of the regime's legitimacy is based on popular legitimacy. So the popular demonstration of consent to the Iranian authority. And when that is degraded, when that is attacked, there'll be consequences in the long term, I think.
Mm-hmm. How are we getting any images at all?
So recently the regime lifted Instagram filtering, so that is now not restricted anymore. VPNs are the number one source of avoiding filtering and censorship.
Can you say what VPN is?
A virtual private network. So a way that you can mask your location, your IP address to access the internet and thereby avoid filtering. There's Tor, which is the Onion Network, which is another way to avoid filtering. So there's many different tools. And some of the tools are incredibly unstable and actually laced with malware, but some of the tools are incredibly effective. Mm. So certainly information's getting out there. Telegram is still blocked, which is significant for the domestic economy and for the market. But certainly, and WeChat is actually available. So there's ways of information getting out, but it's not the kind of citizen journalism that, you know, we saw earlier a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Where do Iranians get alternative? I don't mean it the way we use it here. I mean, where do they get news that isn't generated, sorry, by the government? Can they do that?
Again, I would point you to just the social messaging apps. I think that's why the censoring and filtering of Telegram was so significant, because that is where most Iranians were getting their news. Another great place that Iranians get their news is from satellite television. So Manoto is a television, satellite dish television station coming from London that provides, it's kind of like a news channel, CNN, but catering to the Iranian audience.
So what would you want to leave us with, and what are you worried about with the situation as we wrap this up?
I'm thinking about, I think, trends in Iran, but I think also the larger trends in the global internet. We see this fragmentation of the internet in which more and more states are trying to create their own domestic internets complete with servers and services and messaging apps and other forums within their own borders. And that is concerning for what we understand to be the great experiment and the great tool of the 21st century, that is the internet, and the, you know, the inherent freedom and empowerment that the internet provides.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Emily Blatt, professor in the Department of Media Studies at the University of Virginia, studying history and politics and teaching about media in Iran and cyber warfare and much, many, many more things. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And also, please come back. Hopefully there won't be another, or maybe hopefully there will be another uprising we can talk about that makes
maybe
a difference.
Maybe we'll lift the Muslim ban. You never know.
Yes. Thank you so much. So listen to this, Nancy, okay? You ready?
Okay. Yeah.
This is the palate cleanser. Do you have a palate cleanser for us?
I do, and I have to. I don't care. I don't care if I'm redundant. I love that music, Ellen. I don't care. I love it. Yes, I have one. I have one. It is from David Letterman. He has just last night. He has a new show. It's called My Next Guest Needs No Introduction with David Letterman on Netflix. It's an hour-long episode. About he's got six, I believe, booked, you know, contracted, whatever. And I don't know when the next one is, but the one last night was with Obama, and it was obviously his first talk show and the former president's first talk show. And I am pleased he's going to be back on the air a little bit.
Cool.
So there, what do you got?
Yeah, cool. Okay, this is a little long. I'll try to make it short. There was, in 1965, the first manned mission of a NASA space whatever launch, and it was the Gemini 3. It launched out of Florida's Cape Kennedy, or I used to call it Cape Canaveral. John Young and Gus Grissom went up, and their main objective was to test the spacecraft, but also to test a really, probably really bad-tasting space food. So during a lull in their trip, Young, one of the guys, pulled out a two-day-old corned beef sandwich. from Wolfie's restaurant, which I used to go to. It was
from
called
restaurant,
Wolfie's in Miami Beach,
okay,
which
gotcha,
was used
gotcha.
To be called, I think, the Rascal House. He smuggled the corned beef sandwich aboard, which is really a serious violation because that stuff just, you know, it completely dissolves, and they could have inhaled it in the weightless environment that they were in. And their conversation was really funny. It goes, "What is that? It's a corned beef sandwich. Where'd it come from? I brought it with me. Let's see how it tastes. Smells, doesn't it? Yes, it's breaking up. I'm going to stick it in my pocket. Is it? It was a thought anyways. Yep, not a very good one. Pretty good, though. If it would just hold together. Do you want a turkey leg? Oh, my God. Do you want a turkey leg? That's the funny part. Anyway.
That's the funny part.
It's the whole thing is really funny for me in Miami Beach sense of Borscht Belt sense of humor. Anyway, Nance.
He put the whole launch code, whatever, the whole thing in jeopardy for some corned beef, and it's amazing.
It's true. It's a true story.
I'm sure his mother was impressed. Anyway. That's pretty funny. Well, I had no idea.
Well, thanks again, Nance, for a really great show.
The power of Delhi. That's the moral. The power of Delhi.
Exactly.
Okay, I'm sorry. We're running out of time.
We will see you all. We'll listen to you. You'll hear us, I should say, next time.
Get it right, Ellen.
Get it right. I've been on vacation. And remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. Thanks for tuning in to Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC. Thank you again to our amazing guests, Deirdre Enright and Emily Blout.